We frequently speak of the church as being in the world, but not of the world. We recognize that the church is related in some way or other to the world. Her message, we say, is for the world. But going beyond the simple verbalization of the gospel, what is the church's responsibility to the material and physical aspects of the world? What is their obligation to the physical needs of man? Does she have an obligation in this area? And if so, what is it, and how does she fulfill it? Several months ago, our seminary sent Professor William Denker on an extended three-month tour of Asia, the Far East, and the Middle East to gain personal and direct contact with the mission work of the church in these areas. Professor Denker has returned with some fresh and new insights in the mission work of our church, particularly in the relationship of the spiritual to the material. This morning, the World Mission Council is pleased to present Professor William Denker in a first-hand report of his trip to the East. Professor Denker.
Thank you very much, Mr. Markworth. It's a great pleasure to be back, of course, and to have the opportunity to address colleagues, fathers in Christ, students, and first of all, to express my very sincere thanks to the president, to the academic dean, and the board of control for this priceless opportunity to have a first-hand look at the kind of thing I'm supposed to be talking about around here. There were a great many of us visiting in Asia this year due to the third assembly of the World Council of Churches meeting at New Delhi, and we were referred to in various ways. There were some who made snide remarks about this being the year of the locusts. There were others who referred to us cryptically as CPT, cotton-picking tourists. And there were those who simply dismissed us as the New Delhi fallout. It is difficult, of course, to condense an experience like this in a few moments within the space of one convocation hour, and you will forgive generalizations. We will not always have time to qualify, to modify statements. We're conscious of the inadequacy of statements at this time. There's in us a great unreadiness to be dogmatic. And yet I'd like to share with you some of the tentative findings toward which I'm approaching in this area of materializing the gospel. I believe it was Archbishop William Temple who said that Christianity is the most materialistic religion there is. And there's good foundation for this in the Incarnation. Christianity is the only religion in which the transcendent becomes immanent. It is the only religion in which God becomes man, and does it not simply to appear as a momentary avatar as in Hinduism, but in Christianity, God comes down to earth, becomes a real man, and goes the whole route. Conception, birth, suffering, death, and resurrection. There is nothing like this in any other religion. And so we say that Christianity is an incarnational theology, and God used material means in order to make the incarnation possible. God used the envelope of Mary's virgin body in order to send himself as a living love letter to the human race. In Christians, the gospel is further materialized. Ye are our epistle, says St. Paul. And Martin Luther picked this up and said that each one of us is supposed to be a little Christ. Once again, we have an incarnational theology. And the gospel becomes incarnate also, in a sense, in missionaries, just as in all Christians, who are to show forth in this material world the praises of him who hath called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. Martin Luther emphasized the viva vox, and with Dr. Kemmer here before me, I'm always reminded of his necessary dictum, es muss geschrien werden. And here he's quoting Luther, of course. How shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they be sent? And you've got to have bodies over there to do that. The Board of World Missions hasn't yet discovered any way in which it can send disembodied sprites over to the Far East and the islands of the sea. It takes warm bodies and warm hearts. And it takes vocal cords that are inspired with the living faith to beat upon people's eardrums with this good news, with this treasure that we want to share with them. Jesus' priceless treasure. We heard of it this morning in the chapel address. Bishop James E. Walsh of the Marian Old Fathers, who was imprisoned in Shanghai by the communists under house arrest, said, a missionary is a man who goes to a place where he's not wanted to sell a pearl whose value is not recognized to people who won't even take it as a gift. But he has got to be there to do this unpopular but extremely necessary task. There are great needs for missionaries in Asia, especially this year. You know that the people in New Guinea are asking for the breathtaking request of 22 missionaries this year? 22 in 62. And 8 of these are to be ordained men. In addition, there are nurses, builders, agricultural workers, and the like. The Philippines wants 4 theologically trained man. Japan wants 2, and there's 1 for Taiwan, 1 for the Middle East, and so on. Africa is asking for 5. Let me share with you this thought that overseas missions is good duty. Good duty not only because of what you're doing. You're sharing Christ with people who have little opportunity to learn of him. But I believe that the picture that we have of overseas mission service is a stereotype that is 50 years out of date. Hardly anybody wears a sun helmet anymore. Living conditions are good. In New Guinea, they have running water. They've got ranch-style houses in most of the older stations. And the plumbing is indoors. Not only that, they've got a freezer run every Friday in which a little Cessna plane goes to each of the mission stations that has an airstrip and delivers frozen meat together with cream, fresh cream, from the dairy herd at Yaibus, which is cared for by Mrs. Kleinig, who learned how to do that in Australia. Salary, other living conditions are as good and in some cases better than they are here in the States. Beyond that, a missionary has the chance to travel and see the world. Foreign missions, overseas missions, is good duty. There are exceptions, of course. There are some recruits who are put into frontier situations where for a year or two they may be in the kind of situation that Dr. Basin described this morning. I didn't find any boxcars or general stores over there, but in New Guinea there are places where you've got bush houses way out on the frontier. I spent a night in one of them. Missionary Vic Heineke is living in that bush house with his wife and four children, a new baby born just at New Year's time. And in bush houses, you've got fleas. And you wind up with red dots all over you, even if you spend just one night there, I know. But this doesn't last. And after a year or two, they build a more permanent house, and roads are put in. There are roads now on the highlands of New Guinea. Jeeps are careening back and forth, and you've got motorbikes dashing up and down. And everywhere else is a lot more civilized than New Guinea. So, we need missionaries. But I think our need for missionaries also has to take into consideration the fact that service overseas is not what most of us think it is. The world is changing much faster overseas than it is changing here at home. The materializing of the gospel is something that takes place in the church as well. The church is not just a body of Christians, the church is the body of Christ. We had the opportunity to see some of this materializing of the gospel at New Delhi. There was first the materializing of the reunion of church and mission. This is one of the happy developments of our times. The new biblical studies are leading people to a deep theological recognition of the close and intimate relationship between church and mission, and these are no longer being separated, neatly compartmentalized, as was once the case. And it was not just for organizational reasons, but for theological reasons, that one of the most significant events of the 20th century took place at New Delhi, namely, the union of the International Missionary Council with the World Council of Churches. And it was a real privilege to be there and to see this great and colorful procession moving into the opening service like a bridal procession. One could call this nuptials at New Delhi, and the rear of the procession was brought up by Visser Tooft, the secretary of the World Council of Churches, acting in the role of the dignified groom, and Leslie Newbiggin, the Scotch Presbyterian Archbishop, their duck-billed platypus, as they call him, boyish, rosy-cheeked, as a blushing bride, taking that part of the function. It was a case of the marriage of church and mission being recognized and solemnized at New Delhi. There was here, moreover, the expression of the world church in a very graphic way. For here there was a great multitude out of every race and kindred and nation and tongue under heaven. And what a motley array of vestments were on display here. One was reminded of the dismayed response of a churchman at the first assembly in Amsterdam when he saw this array of disarray. How are we ever going to unite a church that is that has such a bewildering variety of vestments? I'm sure that there are people in the liturgics department who have an answer and an explanation for this, but I'll leave it to them. The The gospel was being materialized in Asian voices in theology at New Delhi. These are the people who are going to help the church express herself in extramural terms. At the opening service, a Burmese preacher spoke of the need for a truly ecumenical theology rather than provincial Western forms of expression. This was something that some Western theologians and churchmen found difficulty in following. As a matter of fact, Franklin Clark Fry's acid comment after the sermon, which had as its announced text the prologue to the fourth gospel, this was his acid comment for sale, one text only slightly used. Uncritical ecumenicalism, let me hasten to add, is no better than uncritical denominationalism. And this is something that certainly our rising generation needs to bear in mind. This is no time for us to be engaging in starry-eyed, naive ecumeniacism. We will not be respected if we move into the situation with this ingenuous approach, because uncritical ecumenicalism, like uncritical denominationalism, uses the same hallowed cliches, uses the same bureaucratic approach to fundamentally theological problems, and the like. Naturally, we shall want to preserve for ourselves, it seems to me, sufficient freedom so that we can actually contribute those gifts which God has given us, and at the same time make sure that we are close enough to the situation that we are sharing those gifts. Someone asked me when I returned from New Delhi, "Are you for the World Council of Churches?" I said, "No, I'm for Christian unity." I believe that the World Council of Churches may be one way in which churches can get together and can listen to one another, can speak to one another. But very few at New Delhi actually wanted to unite the churches on the present basis. One was reminded of Archbishop Frank Woods of Australia, who said, "If we unite the churches we've got now, we'll be in a worse kettle of fish than we are at present." And he said, "At present we have middle-class churches. We need to have some form of the church union in future which will reach across social barriers, across political barriers, across racial barriers." There was the desire for forms of Christian unity better than anything that had been achieved at present. Form must follow function. This was the persuasion of some of the better minds at New Delhi. The relation of creation and redemption was also beautifully expressed, especially by Dr. Joseph Sittler in his paper. One was reminded of Dr. Pelican's comment of some time ago, "The world will not pay much attention to the church's proclamation of the second article until the church has shown that it has understood and believes the first article." And Dr. Sittler in his paper emphasized again and again the great truths of Colossians 1:15-20, that in Christ all things subsist, that by him and for him all things were created, that, as Dr. Sittler put it, the great doctrine of redemption swings within the orbit of the doctrine of creation. And the church needs to take seriously that all things have been redeemed by Christ, for his church. This was to ring in my memory on my later tour of the mission fields. Let me tell you how the gospel is being materialized in some of our mission fields overseas. Quick thumbnail descriptions. First of all, Lebanon. Here, our mission is just getting started. It's a matter of climbing the ladder to the diving board. And Beirut is regarded by many as a first-class jumping-off place into the Middle East. Surveys have to be made. Studies of the Arabic language and the culture are just getting underway. We should not expect any spectacular results at all in missions to the Muslim, and we should not expect much news for some years to come. In India, it appears to me that my big impression is this: there is hope in the land. When the Westerner first comes to India, he feels as though Floyd Patterson had hit him in the solar plexus with a right cross. The poverty, the squalor, the wretchedness of man and beast in India is something that strikes every brand new visitor from the West. It wasn't my first trip to India. I had touched briefly at Bombay in 1955. And I'd seen people sleeping on the streets by thousands because they had no other home. And I heard that in Calcutta at present, 80,000 people are sleeping on the streets. But you know that's good news. Why? There used to be 1 million. Jim Mayer puts it this way. He's one of our dynamic younger missionaries in India. India has progressed from starvation to malnutrition. And if you don't think that's a lot of progress, you should go to India. There's dust, there's dirt in India, especially when the monsoons fail to come. But there's hope in the land. There's hope in many sectors. India is today raising its standard of living. They're making all kinds of things that they weren't manufacturing half a dozen years ago. They're assembling automobiles. Scooters are being made in India, and they're dashing all over the place. Bicycles, the poor man's, the common man's, the middle class man's, vehicle is... the bicycles being made in India today instead of being bought and imported from England or from Japan. And all kinds of things that simply weren't available on the Indian market only 5 or 6 years ago, as our missionaries can tell you, are today being sold there. Electrification is proceeding apace. The villages are lighting up. There's hope in the land. And down in South India, you see the yellow signs all over the rice paddies, and they say these fields are being cultivated according to the Japanese method. Japan has extended a foreign aid program to India, too. They're part of the Aid India Club. And they've sent 100 young farmers to India to teach the people how to increase their yield. Fertilizer factories are being built with the help of the Japanese. I've found an able young engineer at Delhi whose business it was to do just that. And I talked to a farmer in a rice paddy. I stopped to take his picture plowing in the rice paddy, and I asked him, "How does the future of your country look to you?" And this man knew what was being done for his country. He said, "Thanks to the help we're getting from your country, I think the future looks pretty good." The farmer in the rice paddy knows that foreign aid is coming to him from America. There's hope in the church. The church has organized itself in the Indian Evangelical Lutheran Church. Leaders are grappling with thorny problems of many kinds. They're wrestling with the theological problems involved in their contact with other Lutherans, with the Church of South India, and they're growing. There's hope for the church in many ways. India is making real progress towards self-support. And I got over the ideas that I had had that, after all, India wouldn't actually be able to achieve a self-supporting church. This isn't true. But we must hurry on to New Guinea. New Guinea, I found it to be a race against time. This is a dimension that I simply hadn't caught from over here. But wherever I went, Leaders in government told me, we figure that at most we have 10 or 12 years. And one native whom I asked, when there was no white man around, said, I think we'll get independence in 5 or 6 years. And now with Sukarno, beating the war drums, beginning to chew away at West New Guinea, there is, of course, cause for more and more concern about our missions in the other end. I don't believe that an Indonesian takeover will necessarily mean the end of our missions, because there are missionaries that work in Indonesia, but we will not have the same favored position that we do under the Australian government, which favors Christianity in a quite unabashed fashion. Religion is a required course in the curriculum, and Christianity, the Bible, is the basis. They've even been able, in the mission schools in New Guinea, to do something quite unheard of. They've found a translation of the English Bible, which is acceptable to both Roman Catholic and Protestant missionaries, for use in the school. New Guinea is, of course, just emerging from the Stone Age. It isn't true that I brought along this axe to keep people from leaving the auditorium at the beginning of the convocation hour. I brought it along just as a symbol of where New Guinea is, or where it was, a dozen years ago in the highlands. This is about as useless as a lodge sword. This is a ceremonial axe, and it's not the kind with which they used to chop down trees. That was hard enough to do. Chopping down a tree with a stone axe takes a day and a half, I was told, by the elder of one of our churches on the highlands. And by that time, your back is breaking, your head is bursting, and you are just a wreck. And so, when the mission comes in and opens a trade store and sells steel axes, this is a tremendous thing. This, what a labor-saving device. The steel axe is one of the first things that every man on the highlands wants to have. Every boy, as soon as he can afford one, will get one. A boy doesn't need much in the way of clothing. He does need a belt. He doesn't really need anything else. He needs the belt to stick his axe in. Or if he can't afford an axe, he gets a knife. But this is important to those people. It would be important to you and me if we had to chop down trees with stone, with dull stone axes. And incarnational theology is being practiced in other ways. Missionaries are making chickens available to the people, a better breed of pigs. They're bringing in vegetable seeds, distributing them to the people, medicine at our hospital. There are schools going in all over the highlands. Agricultural progress is being fostered. This is a total program to the whole man in his whole society in New Guinea. Nowhere else do we have our hands on the vitals of a whole people as we have in New Guinea. And this is one reason why we have the kind of mass movement, the mass response that we have there. If we didn't have any trade stores, for example, there's every good chance that the people would all go over to the Popis. The Popis, as you suspect, are in pidgin English, the Roman Catholics. And sometimes I have the feeling that our missionaries say that word with a little more relish than the spiritual man really ought to use. In the Philippines, we have a great deal of the same kind of work being done. You have the mountains of North Luzon, in which our missionaries are again seeking to meet the material needs of the people as well as their spiritual needs. They're moving in with chickens, pigs, and with mountain clinics along the mountain trail road in North Luzon. And I saw how right next to the church, the people of one community were building a clinic at the station where Geraine Hornig of recent vintage is at work. The mission was paying only two of the men at work. There were 20 others from the community pitching in to build that clinic to meet their material needs. And right next door to it was the church to meet their basic spiritual need, their alienation from Christ, from God, through the message of reconciliation in Jesus Christ. Hong Kong's high point was the All-Asia Conference. What a difference between this and the meeting at New Delhi. At New Delhi, there had been 2,000 people. At Hong Kong, we had about 17 or 18 meeting in an upper room. The fellowship was close. The fellowship was wonderful. We had here, for the first time, representatives of the seven churches of Asia, as Dr. G quickly dubbed them, meeting together in fellowship. And now, for the first time, the lines of communication from one Asian church to another did not have to go via St. Louis. There was direct contact. The ministry to the whole man in Hong Kong included, in addition to the spiritual, of which Dr. Bartling's excellent studies on the Epistle to the Ephesians were the high point, a whole series of projects for meeting the needs of men. In Hong Kong, you have some of the largest schools in the Missouri Synod, Concordia School, the brand new Kwindong School. These have 1,500 pupils. They're big, they're handsome, and amazingly, they're self-supporting. Out of tuition, these schools repay their cost in a period of 11 years' time. One finds here also the Haven of Hope, TB Sanitarium. How this has grown in the years since I saw it last in 1955. A ministry to the people who come broken in body, mostly from mainland China, suffering from TB. And here they get healing for body and for soul. Martha Boss, the Mighty Mite in Hong Kong, has a handcraft project which was just in its infancy in 1955. Now she's doing an annual business of $60,000 to $70,000. And she has moved from Rennie's Mill refugee camp to a downtown office and showroom. The important thing is that 400 women are getting rice with self-respect through this program. Unfortunately, there are also some ghosts of the past in a flourishing present at Hong Kong. Some of the past paternalism and ecclesiastical colonialism which characterized parts of the operation on mainland China have not yet been completely shaken off. And the people need a much larger share in the conduct of the church in Hong Kong, which, as one American newspaper man observed, could be taken in any morning like the morning newspaper by the Reds. Taiwan, it's youth to the fore. There's a missionary staff which is bringing heavy responsibility to the shoulders of four young men. By this summer, there's every likelihood that the senior man on the field will have had less than 3 years' experience. Ron Halamka, who graduated here a year and a half ago, is chairman of the conference, and he's head of the seminary program. And in a year and a half, has made astonishing progress in the Mandarin language. He interpreted for Dr. Bartling and for myself, also in a pastoral conference. And any missionary will tell you that's not easy. Problems of direct relief were seen here on Taiwan. The churches are the distribution centers for United States government relief. And this is not good. Self-help projects take much more thought, much more time than handing somebody a can of milk powder and saying next, but they preserve human dignity and self-respect. On Okinawa, we saw a bit of incarnational theology. This was Anglican. We strayed a bit from the Lutheran fold here and then, and I don't know whether this is Unionism, but I bought this Episcopalian cloth. This is some cloth which is made in St. John's Craft Center. Now here's an Anglican church on the island of Okinawa, fine church, active parish, good rector, but he is endeavoring to do something about the material needs of people in this economically very depressed island. They're not sharing in the prosperity of Japan. So, in what would normally be the parish house, he has set up a whole battery of looms. And about 100 women in Okinawa earn twice as much through this cooperative approach to the business of weaving cloth as they would on the outside. And he's not selling these at church bazaars in the United States. This is being marketed through top flight department stores in the USA. And this, again, is an interesting approach to incarnational theology, an interesting approach to meeting the needs of the whole man. In Japan, missionaries talk about hitting a blank wall. In terms of the organizational institutional church, this is true. But in terms of the leavening action of the gospel, I'm not so sure that it is true. And even in terms of the church, we find here a growth. 10 years ago, the church was 0.5% of the total population. Today, it's 0.75. This is an increase, whereas in many parts of the world, the percentage rate is dwindling. For me, coming to Japan was, of course, an interesting homecoming. And I was moved even more by my first attendance at a church service in Japan than I was when I saw the Taj Mahal. Japan had changed. I felt like Rip Van Winkle. Tokyo has, in the 14 years since I arrived there in 1948, exactly doubled in size. It was 5 million then, it's 10 million now. It hit that figure just the day before I arrived. And Tokyo is today prosperous. I was amazed to see the well-dressed crowds on the streets. Automobiles, all the colors of the rainbow on the streets. Exactly the same phenomenon that had amazed me when I'd come back to America in 1955 after a 7-year absence. And it isn't only Tokyo, but other cities have doubled in exactly the same way. The growth of cities in Asia is far more rapid than in the USA. The tempo, the rate of change in society is faster in the Orient than it is in the USA. They're not as far as we are. But they're moving faster. That's the point. And in Japan, for example, they're not making stone axes. This is one of the things they make. Here's a little transistor radio I picked up there. What a contrast to New Guinea. Both ends of the spectrum. And incidentally, in New Guinea, I had been able to speak Japanese. Down at Lae on the coast, there was a group of Japanese scientists who'd come with 100 tons of precision equipment, and these men were there to observe the solar eclipse of February 5th. This transistor radio, it was unique to me. It has a watch in it. And it does it just about what a clock radio will do. It'll turn on automatically whenever you want it to. Now, I don't know of anybody else in the world who's making this kind of thing. The Japanese are able to do it. And this design, incidentally, also won a prize in the Japan Design House, according to a friend of mine who is active in that spot. In Korea, well, let me say first that in Japan I found the new religion growing apace. And we find a good many Christian accents popping up in them. Groups like the Itoen are radicalizing the idea of Christian service. In order to be a member there, you have to volunteer for the most menial service to your neighbor, including the cleaning out of the utility end of his household. They take seriously the business of serving others. And the Soka Gakkai, which is growing at a fantastic rate, which is a radical rightist group, is emphasizing in its literature, which is now being published also in English, that they want to concentrate on the unity and harmony of the spiritual and the material in the total life of man. Now, this is a Judeo-Christian concept which we have to take with a certain degree of shame from others. Perhaps this is due to the fact that we have in the past too frequently spiritualized our message, over-spiritualized it, in terms of our Greek philosophic heritage, in which the ideal is clean and good and the material is regarded as unclean and not good. In Korea, we found that our young men were making an ecumenical contribution in Lutheran terms, particularly Dr. G. And our seminary can be proud of the fact that it has given him a doctor's degree. He's a one-man army. He's produced 3 books of his own, translated 2 or 3 others. He lectures all over. He teaches courses in the theology of Luther in a Presbyterian seminary. And in addition to this, he finds time to edit a magazine which sells on the newsstands. Besides that, he also directs the Korean Lutheran Hour and heads the Christian Correspondence course. What he does with his spare time, I don't know. Basic language study is over for our first missionaries, and they're fanning out over the country now, beginning the itineration, which we trust will lead to the organization of indigenous churches. We saw in Korea the opportunity to acquire a Seoul Lutheran Center, which would house a servicemen's memorial library, the offices of the Lutheran Hour, and would be a nerve center for our whole operation in Korea, and we certainly hope this can be acquired. It appears to me in the light of this trip that we need to rethink the relation of the spiritual and the material. It seems to me that we will need to focus on people's needs rather than on the church's needs, as we may have done at times in the past. The world is not to be regarded as the place from which we conscript recruits and finances, but the object of the church's love and service. Old patterns for new days may have a certain applicability today. The medieval monastery was a self-sustaining unit as it moved out across northern Europe and converted our forefathers. And without emphasizing the celibate aspect of the situation, we need to concentrate, I think, on the self-sustaining character of these institutions, on their union of the spiritual and the material. They were engaged in farming and agriculture, and they found a material basis for the church as they moved out. In the Far East today, the church is going to need a material basis. And my consuming fear is that as the cities of Asia boom and grow, the church will have no place to plant her feet. These churches, these cities are growing up over the head of the church. And as a young man in Japan put it to me, society is moving very fast and the church is going very slow. We shall need to have new approaches in order to catch up We may have to find new ways of being self-supporting. And we can't just lay down the game and say, you've got to do it the same way we do it in America. The duplex envelope system is fine for a rich middle class and a big middle class as we have it. It may not be the answer for Asia. They tell us, you dictate the game and then you set down the rules. We've got to do it your way. We can't do it your way. And yet they want to be self-supporting. The Karens of Burma say, if we eat our own rice, we can do things our own way. We have to give them the freedom to find new and creative ways of self-support. There's need for further studies in this area, theological studies of the relation between the spiritual and the material ministry in the church. I'm not in favor of any social gospel. The trouble with Rauschenbusch and his cohorts was that they forgot the gospel. I am proposing that we move to the meeting of the full spectrum of man's material, physical, social, psychological needs. Not because we have forgotten the gospel, but because we remember it. And that makes a big difference. We need further study on the mission fields of the Far East regarding possible breakthroughs towards self-support, towards the union of the spiritual and the material as we approach the needs of men. And we need young men who are ready to be venturesome, young men who are ready to be soundly and thoroughly biblical, and who are ready to love their fellow man with their whole heart. Let me stop here and allow room for at least a question or two. Marco.
Are there any questions you wish to address to President?
Yes.
Since the cities are growing in such leaps and bounds, has the church in Asia been able to adapt their message to meet with the inner city mission, so to speak?
One of their basic problems is finding the money to get into the inner city. To get into the cities of Asia before you even have the chance to get the message there. Admittedly, you don't always have to have an institutional, a brick and mortar approach, but the church does need some place to rest your feet. And real estate prices in some of these cities are fantastic. In Tokyo, for example, a missionary residence is under construction for missionary Henry Schriever, a recent graduation here. The land, small parcel, is going to cost $36,000. And it's way out. It's not anywhere near the heart of the city. Some of the land that we purchased years ago at a reasonable figure, one plot, for instance, for which we paid $5,000, is today worth $300,000. One of the things the church is going to have to do is to raise its sights here in America. Foreign missions from here on is going to cost money. This is going to be something that we're going to have to get used to. And this is also one reason for supplementing, for looking for ways for the church to become indigenous in the Far East through finding other collateral means of self-support. Now, the message. The message in the city, I think it's been easier for us in some places to reach the man in the city than it has been to reach the man in the country. In India, it's the village man we've reached, the farmer, the peasant, the outcast. In Japan, 90% of all the Christians are in the city. And there it's the middle-class man, the student, the white-collar worker whom we've been reaching. We have not reached the laboring man. We have not reached the farmer in Japan. We have not reached, especially, the man in the fishing village. And he's the one man who's not sharing in Japan's newfound prosperity.
We have about 1 minute. Is there another question? Right.
Their need for sociological and anthropological studies.
Very much so. There's a tremendous need for an anthropological study to be made in New Guinea. These folks here, with their stone axes and their new steel axes. We need somebody to go in there and say, what's happening to this society under the impact of cultural change which the missionaries have brought? We never bring just the gospel. We bring a lot of other equipment with it.
I wish to express our thanks to Professor Necker for the report this morning. I'm sure we gain new insights in the mission work of the church, and not only insights.